actually combined the normal talk I give on our IPAMS project with the questions that were forwarded to me by the organizers on trying to discuss, well, how do we develop this project and how do we put it together? And I will point out that in the invasive biology of invasive weedy or weedy and invasive species program, they do a pre-proposal. You put in a short 1 to 2 page pre-proposal, and the program director looks at those and says, well, yeah, I like this, or no, I don't like that, or whatever, and gets back to you. So try and weed down the thousands of requests they had been getting to a manageable number of proposals. So from the time you hear back on your pre-proposal, the time the proposals are due, it's about a month and a half. So that kind of answers, well, how long did you work on the proposal? Well, we worked on it all the time between the time our pre-proposal was accepted to the time the proposals were due. So I'll discuss about how the project developed and a little bit about the project itself. This is our team. I'm the project director and the person in charge. I'm the person that when we get behind, I'll hear from Dr. Bowers about it. And in addition, what we've done in our project is we have a specific leader for the extension component and a specific leader for the research component. So the integrated project is supposed to be a melding of research and extension, or research and education, or extension and education. We decided to make it very explicit that we had a research component and we had an extension component, and then be very explicit about how the two components related to each other so that they were integrating with each other. So I'm in charge of the extension component. I have a 60% research and 40% extension appointment. Our research leader has a teaching and research appointment. This is Gary Irvin here. We have a webmaster who is in charge of developing our web page. That's Cliff Abbott. And then the other members of our team include John Bird, who's a well-known extension specialist in the area of invasive weeds, very well-known both in the state and the region. And we have Victor Maddox, who is my postdoc and is an excellent field botanist. That pointer there, I have no control over that, do I? It's just like, oh, okay. You're scaring me. That's the Wizard of Oz back there, by the way, the man behind the black curtain. And then we have two other people outside of the university on our project team, the first being Dr. Les Mirhoff, who's with University of Connecticut and one of the two project directors on the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England, and Dr. Randy Westbrooks, who's with U.S. Geological Survey and is, I consider him the father of early detection and rapid response. So he's a person who's been working in early detection and rapid response to invasive weeds throughout North America. Problem identification. It was easy for us to decide to work on invasive plants. The Mississippi State University and the USGS have been working on invasive plants and other invasive species issues for several years. We have already noted that there is a need for more research in the Mid-South on invasive species and particularly on invasive plants, and had identified the need for developing a database of where invasive plants were located in the Mid-South through our process. And we had also identified the previous success of the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England and decided that we were going to emulate their success. It was at that time that I heard about the integrated program. So really, I had an idea and it matched the program. Invasive plants, by the way, are a big problem. This is where I go back to my normal talk on the Invasive Plant Atlas of the Mid-South. There are an estimated 17,000 species of native plants in the United States. There are approximately 5,000 introduced plant species that are now found in the landscape. So that's a significant proportion of the flora in the United States. Invasive plants cost the economy an estimated $34 billion, that's billion dollars per year. Yet these costs are spread across all sectors of the economy. So this is a significant problem. Despite this large cumulative cost, the problem is dispersed in the landscape, in every type of managed land, and every type of industry. The costs are typically borne by individual landowners or, in the case of public lands, individual resource agencies. The problem is so large that no single government agency has the resources or personnel to survey, well, essentially the entire United States, and to manage all those infestations. With invasive plants, it's critical that the public get involved. And the number of different species is simply too large for a public awareness campaign. We can't make posters of all 5,000 species and say, look out for this problem, look out for that problem. It really requires a deeper level of understanding from at least some component of the public. As you can see, we were given specific questions to try and address. So what was the process? Well, we already had a team. The team had been working together since 2004 on invasive species issues. So we basically brought an existing team and applied it to this particular project, this particular proposal. And the basic timeline of our three-year project is the first year we'll be spent developing materials and the web page and the other things that we will have in the project, as well as in the research area. They've already started going out and doing specific surveys for their component. And then in years two and three, we will be presenting workshops in each of the five states to train lay volunteers into identifying plants and how to enter that into the database. And I'll go into more detail on that a little bit later. As I mentioned, the team had already worked together before on invasive plant projects with our U.S. Geological Survey Cooperative Agreement. We saw the need for prior experience, and so we invited Dr. Mirhoff to join this project team. They had a successful program. In fact, the IPAIN was funded by NRI and was one of the original integrated projects. So I guess we are cheating. We got expert help in developing our proposal, learning from some of the mistakes they had initially. When we wrote the proposal, we fully expected it would be rejected once or sent back for revision, and we'd have to rewrite it and send it back again. But we actually were funded on our first time, and I think that's largely due to the fact that Les Mirhoff was able to give us very significant pointers in developing our proposal and developing our project. A little bit about the predecessor, about IPAIN, the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England. In 4 years, they trained over 500 volunteers to detect new infestations of invasive plants. They had entered over 6,000 herbarium records and 7,000 field observations into their database in 4 years, so a total of 13,000 observations, creating a very dense network of points that have been observed throughout that area. And so we wanted to do something very similar in the Mid-South, of having a large number of volunteers going out and surveying areas for existing locations of invasive plants. What sort of stakeholder input did we use? Well, we actually have gotten input from a number of sources, and we'll be working with a number of different groups through this process. The first, statewide extension agents and the extension system. In particular, Master Gardeners, which is a program and extension, have been very vocal in wanting to work with us, as well as the garden clubs. They've really been pushing us to get going even faster than we have. We also have had a very active group within the state of Mississippi called the Cogan Grass Task Force, which is a group that until recently was focused on one species, Cogan grass, and where it's located and how to control it. Through that group, we had developed a group called the Mississippi Invasive Species Alliance, and that group is again a cooperative group of state agencies, federal agencies that work within the state, concern groups, the Forestry Commission, groups of that nature, all working together on invasive weeds. And then there's another group that we have worked with, the state chapters and the regional Southeastern Exotic Pest Plant Councils. These are groups that are largely composed of natural resource agency personnel that are interested in invasive weeds and getting them to buy in required that I volunteer to be the conference chairman for the next conference, but we got their buy-in to help us with this project. So I'll talk a little bit more about the project specifically, sort of our project outline, how we've divided research and extension activities, and a little bit about our web-based database. For the extension component, the purpose is to train lay volunteers. One term that's used widely is the term citizen scientists. Many scientists object to that term, by the way. You know, they kind of feel like, hey, you mean I didn't have to go to graduate school for 6 years to become a scientist? I could have just been a citizen. And but that is a term that's widely used, so I thought I'd put it in there just so people would recognize that term when they hear it. But we have an ambitious goal of training these lay volunteers to identify 40 common invasive weeds, and then to train them to enter that data into a regional database. And then use that data, so this is how the extension project feeds into the research project. We will use that data to predict locations of invasive weeds in the landscape. And our focus is in the mid-south states of Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. So breaking into the components, again, we'll train volunteers to identify these species. We will also train them to essentially be our early detection and rapid response group, where when they notify us through the database of a location of a specific species, we will then pass that information on to responsible individuals, and I'll explain that a little bit more. We will also be developing best management practices information so that they will know the best way to manage those specific species if they find that in their land. A lot of the management of invasive weeds happens by private landowners, yet they often don't have appropriate information on how to properly control those species. We will also develop some assessment methodologies, and then database will have a method of mapping the data that's in the database, and that will help to determine the distribution of the species of interest and allow us to also provide predictions of where some of these species may be found next. This list of 40 species is a little bit daunting. We, in response to the RFP, the RFP specifically states that this is a program that looks at weedy or invasive species in agroecosystems. So we wanted to be sure to target all sorts of ecosystems, but be sure to include important agroecosystems like row crop agriculture, pasture lands, and managed forests. But we have, in addition, rights of way, which are a very common avenue for the spread of these invasive species, wildlands, which would be natural areas, and then aquatic and wetland sites. We also purposely bound species that are common, sparse, rare, or not yet in that region or the state. These species were actually selected on a priority scale based also on were they a federal listed noxious weed or were they in a state noxious weed list, if they are in either of those, we basically automatically included them in our list. And then we also looked at the state exotic pest plant council's list of important invasive weeds in those states and selected from those to fit these habitats. I'm not going to read all these species because this is going to, you know, certainly put you to sleep if you're not already asleep. But just to point out, for instance, for row crops, we have 7 different species. There, one of the species that's of great concern recently is Bengal dayflower, which is resistant to glyphosate products. So this is a weed that's becoming more prevalent because of current agricultural practices. So we want to focus on that particular species. We have a species on there, Palmer amaranth. We're not sure if we really want to get into trying to have them separate one amaranth from another, so we may replace that species at a later date, but that's currently on the list because that's also a species of great interest because of the resistance issue. We also have a number of pasture weeds, and you can see these. One of the main weeds of concern in the southeast from this category is Kogan grass. This is a grass that's very invasive, changes the fire frequency, and is very difficult to control. We have a number of species from managed forests. I think there are 8 on that list there. And of course, obviously, some of these species can be in a variety of land uses, but we just selected ones that seemed to make the most sense which category they go into. We have, I think, 6 species from rights of way. We also had 5 species listed as wild, or 6 species listed as wildland, and 8 for aquatic and wetlands. I think mostly because I work with aquatics, so I felt like I wanted more species from aquatics in there. An important component of this is early detection and rapid response, and these are the 6 principles or 5 principles of early detection and rapid response systems. But we want to not only train volunteers to identify the plants, but we want to have a system whereby you not only see the plant, but you do something about it. So as part of our system, we will be notifying responsible agencies. If there's if it's a public land, we'll notify the management organization that there is a invasive species location on their property. If it's a federal species of concern or a state species of concern for which there's a program, we'll notify the person in charge of that program of location of this species so that they can take appropriate action. Of course, all extension programs have workshops, and in our workshops, our goal is to have at least 2 workshops in each state over the final 2 years of the program, and to have them geographically distributed so that people can potentially go to a workshop with relative ease. We would have, for instance, a workshop in Western Tennessee and Eastern Tennessee. We would have a workshop in Northern Mississippi and Southern Mississippi so that people could attend these with some ease. The volunteers, again, would be trained in species identification, how to enter the data into the database, and also trained in how to control these species appropriately. We will provide them with a training manual that we're currently developing. We're in the first year, and we're finding one of the challenges is developing the materials. It's taking longer than we thought. We'll also be handing them some other tools, for instance, an identification pack of cards so that they can quickly identify species based on that. And then we're also going to be developing incentives for people that enter data into the database. If you get to, you know, 5 sites, we'll send you a t-shirt. IPAM's the t-shirt. If you get to 10 sites, you'll get IPAM's the water bottle, and so on. The research, is a separate or is a distinct component, where the first activity that they're currently engaged in is to conduct a systematic regional vegetation survey to assess and monitor the distribution of the key invasive species, and then to quantify based on some of those geospatial databases, recent changes in land use and land cover surrounding each of the survey points to determine how changes in land use are affecting the distribution of invasive species. We're also going to be developing some quantitative models to support refinement of search efforts to help guide volunteers or our professional surveyors to find problematic invasive species, for instance, to help find some of the more rare species. And then also we're going to compare the data collected by the professional surveyors to the data collected through volunteer surveys to see how effective volunteer surveys versus the professional surveys are. So this is again a way for the integration of research and extension together. We're using data from volunteers in our research. We're assessing the volunteer efforts to the professional efforts to see how effective that is. The professional surveys are based on a stratified survey technique where we're taking each ecoregion within the five states, we're identifying land use types, and we're randomly selecting points within each of those land use types, as much as possible trying to use public lands or lands at which we would not get shot at for coming onto them. Okay. Essentially, a third component of all this is our webpage. Our webpage will be a very significant component to the, particularly in terms of a long-term product. We were supposed to launch this in July of 2007, and in fact, if you enter that address, you will find something at that site, but it's not a completed webpage because, in fact, one of the challenges is it's taking longer for us to develop those materials than we thought. But this webpage at the address indicated there, we'll have a database of locations at which we've observed these invasive species, and it will be linked to an ArcIMS server, which is a fancy way of saying that the database will be expressed in a GIS map. And on the left-hand side is an example of another ArcIMS database that we are currently serving, which is the Cactus Moth Detection and Monitoring Network, and you can see how the observations that have been made of both prickly pear cactus populations and the invasive cactus moth are mapped out on that particular map. And this is essentially the same feature that we will have for the invasive plant populations. This data will be downloadable so that people could access the data and use it for other research needs. And one of the long-term benefits of this program is that we will also have data exchanges. We already have agreements for data exchanges with the National Institutes for Invasive Species Science, which is a USGS program, with the National Biological Information Infrastructure Invasive Species Information Node, which is why we use initials, with the Southern Appalachian Information Node of MBII, with the USGS Non-Indigenous Aquatic Species Site in Florida, and then also with the USDA APHIS database, NAPIS, as appropriate. And we would contribute data to that, actually not directly from our webpage, but through the state coordinators that NAPIS has. This web portal would also provide information on the ecology and management of these invasive weeds, provide the mapping interface, and each user would register. Anybody can register, but you'd have to be a registered user to enter data. And then you would also be able to sign up for notifications. The notifications mean that if you can sign up to receive information on a particular species that interests you, or if there is a species found within your county or within a group of counties or within your state, you would be notified of that by email. And this is how we would set up the notifications to federal or state authorities of species found within their sites. One of the issues with this, of course, is what happens after the grant. And so when questioned about maintaining the collaboration, this is what I thought of. We already have a partnership going with NBII and with the USGS Invasive Species Program. And so after this grant, we would be able to maintain at least the database, if not the educational program, through that partnership. Project management. Well, we have one overall project leader. That's me. And we have one leader for each of the research and extension efforts. And then we delegate other activities as needed. We don't have regular meetings. We probably should. We have a meeting set up to go over our educational materials in December. And we see each other. Most of the people in this project we actually see on a regular basis since we're working together on other projects. What are some of the challenges? Well, the first is the timeline. I was overly ambitious in thinking that we could develop a manual and a web page in the time I allotted. I thought it would take 6 months. It's actually going to take closer to a year. We know several contacts in some of the states, but we don't have contacts in all the states. So we're going to have to work on developing some of those contacts and developing hosts for some of our workshops. And that's something that we probably could have done on the front end rather than at this point. And then discussing some of the unexpected benefits and barriers with integrated projects. Well, I think one of the great benefits is getting the involvement of the public. I think that there's the assumption, especially by scientists, that the public supports our research efforts. I don't think that that is a good assumption. I think that we need to develop that sort of support in the public. And one way of doing that is to involve the public in some of these issues. And the integrated project is one way to do that. Particularly on the invasive species issue, the integrated project will help to raise the awareness level of people on the invasive species and tell them specifically what they can do to help with that effort. Likewise, using volunteers obviously is an inexpensive method of collecting data. Now, obviously, the quality of data is not going to be as good as the quality of data that you would get from a professional, but we also hope to be assessing, well, how accurate is this data? We also have a person who will be vetting some of the data that's coming in to make sure that we're maintaining good quality of data. What are some of the barriers? Well, really, the only barriers I've seen have been actually with our peers, namely that many scientists resent the idea that any of their research money in NRI is being taken away from basic research and going to integration. And many of them do not perceive the need for getting the buy-in from the public. So I think we need to get the buy-in from our colleagues and try to show them how important these integrated projects can be in helping to grow the funding for science and grow the buy-in of the public to the science. I was actually quite surprised. I was at the Weed Science Society of America. That's a society that I'm more involved in. And at that group, Dr. Bowers, who's in charge of the Weedy Species Program, had a meeting about integrated projects. And there were a number of people at that meeting who had had funding from NRI in the past were very resentful of the idea that any money would be taken away from basic science and go to integrated projects. So I think we need to work on that perception within the scientific community as much or more than working with the public to accept that difference. So we have a number of expected outcomes from this. Obviously, in research, the development of a model that will have direct applicability in helping to find specific invasive species will be a very useful tool for finding and controlling specific invasive species. The extension product of having a ready-made workshop course on invasive plants will be a very useful tool in and of itself. The web-based database and that mapping project, I think, will be a long-term ongoing product that will help the many different groups that are working on invasive plant issues in the Mid-South gather information and be able to address the problem of managing those species. In terms of networking, it's really helping to bring individuals together who are working on invasive plant issues and to build that sort of sense of consensus and movement, making progress on the issue. And then lastly, increasing public awareness and the perception of the problem and being able to do something about it. So again, I'd like to thank USDA for the support through this program. And here's my contact information. I'd be glad to get correspondence from any of you in the future on our project in particular or integrated projects in general in the future. Thank you. Okay, the question was, how do we handle the data quality issue? We have identified a person, Victor Maddox, I mentioned before, to actually go through records. So when records are entered into our database, they're actually put into a pool of records that have to be examined and verified before they go on. And largely, it's going to catch things like, improbable locations of plants or improbable locations of anything. With our cactus database, for instance, we have a number of citations that have ended up out in the middle of the ocean. We've been able to solve that problem. We have the capability of adding pictures. So if someone's unsure of their identification, they can include a picture. And Victor is very adept at identifying plants from pictures. And if they register, they'll also have at least one means of contact so he can get back to them and talk to them. We are fortunate to have Victor working with us because, unlike many of us, he loves nothing better than the excuse to leave the office and go out anywhere in the five-state area and identify plants. That's his idea of a dream job. So he'll probably be following up a number of those that he's unsure of. But there is going to be a longer-term problem of, there are going to be a number of plants that are misidentified. We have specific requirement of the question is, how do you standardize location information? The database will only accept certain types of geographic information. So if you're a volunteer, you're going to have access either to a global positioning system receiver, and nowadays, I don't know what it's like up in Wisconsin, but every adult male in Mississippi has a GPS. You know, it's either on their bass boat or on their four-wheeler, So that is going to be less of a hurdle than we thought. But we also have a system whereby you can take a street address or locate the site on the map and get a GPS coordinate from it and locate your spot that way. I should point out that all of our information for volunteer observations is based on the North American Weed Management Association data requirements. So we have sort of a standard format for entering data and what sorts of information they want. Yes, sir. Okay, the question is, are the locations identified as to whether the sighting was obtained from a lay volunteer or a professional scientist? No, at this point, they're not. There's concern about releasing too much information about individuals over the web. So while that information is in the database, if we had a question about it, we could go back and check. But if you were looking at the database, that would not be immediately obvious. Though that may be you know, if there's a continuing concern about that issue, that is something we could work into the database and go back and fix. But at this point, the observations, there's going to be no distinction in terms of whether it was a volunteer observation or a professional observation. Ma'am. Where are we going to be publishing the survey data? Well, the actual observations of where species are occurring will be in the database, and that database will be accessible by the public. So, well, other products. Well, the research papers will be published in peer-reviewed journals. In fact, there are two that are in the process of being submitted right now from the research effort. One of them is probably cutting our own throat, but the observation that Gary has made is that a number of the invasive species are not found very often more than 100 feet from a road. That if you go out, you know, if you do a random survey out in the middle of, you know, a forest or something, you tend not to find invasive species. They tend to be right along these transportation corridors, which was not an assumption we had. People have talked about it, but that's not really been published. So there will be some publication in that way. The extension materials will be a publication of our extension service, and so that will also be available as a standalone, as well as each of the 40 species will not only be available in our manual, but individually each species will have a two-page fact sheet that will be available on the web page. So we'll have a number of avenues for publishing information from this, but I anticipate a number of peer-reviewed journal publications on the database per se will probably not be in the to a peer-reviewed journal, but I'm sure that as data starts coming in, we will start seeing some patterns from that will trigger peer-reviewed journal publications.